damage report still under lockdown following the third day of the DNC and perhaps one of the most exciting days. Very thrilled to be breaking that down, but I won't be doing it alone. Joining us for the first time as a co-host of the Damage Report, we have the Emmy nominated TV news commentator and host of Real Talk, Dr. Rashad Rishi. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Man, that was an awesome introduction, man. Thank you for having me here, man. I appreciate you, John.
I'm glad to have you on. We spoke a few months ago. I believe it was about 3 months ago. We spoke about Ahmaud Arbery and that tragic case. And thrilled to have you back on and touch base with what's been going on in the country.
I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. And for those of you in the chat, there are several thousand of you there. Please hit the like button so that people know that this stream is active. Another way to do that is, of course, you can tweet about it. You can share the stream. That would be great. And while we're doing this show, as always, we're going to be following your comments, your tweets, your Twitches, your super chats, and all of that. Both myself and Rashad will be responding to those as we go along. And we'll be going along through a number of very important topics, including a lot of wrap up or I guess response to last night's DNC. There were some pretty good speeches, I thought. Rashad, you've been watching each night?
Yeah, man, I've watched each night. I mean, this has been the most exciting night. Yesterday was the most exciting night. The speeches have not been just super thrilling, but you can expect that in a virtual delivery reality. You don't have a crowd, you don't have that energy. You don't have a lot of off the cuff moments because everything is really scripted, right? Which I think is gonna be great for Joe Biden, by the way. So now we have the official announcement of Kamala Harris being the vice presidential running mate for the Democratic Party. A lot of excitement around that, obviously.
Yeah, that was, I think it probably was overall the most exciting night. And we'll be going through a number of different parts about that. But we also have Trump with a little wink and a nod to QAnon. You know, they're just good people. So we're going to be talking about that. We've got some breaking news involving Steve Bannon. But normally we would lead off with the breaking news, but it is Steve Bannon. Screw him, he can wait until halfway through the show, but we'll get to him. Then we've got a little bit on coronavirus. And Greenland and Puerto Rico, what do they have to do with each other? We'll find out a little bit later on in the show. Oh, can I just briefly mention before we launch into it, this happened way too close to the show for us to actually produce anything. But Rashad, I don't know if you saw this. It was announced just moments earlier that Nancy Pelosi is endorsing Joe Kennedy in the very divisive, obviously a lot of focus on primary match against Ed Markey for Senate, which I was not expecting. When I saw the first tweet, I said, this isn't real, right? She's definitely not endorsing this challenger to the sitting incumbent Democratic senator. But from everything I could see, no, she endorsed Joe Kennedy.
John, wait a minute, man. Have we made sure her Twitter account has not been hacked by somebody else? Has this been double and triple confirmed?
Look, Boston Globe confirmed it, I guess, as well as some Twitter account I follow that tweets out polls. Okay. But everybody seems to be running with it, and I haven't seen any massive like hold, pump the brakes thing. No, she's endorsing Joe Kennedy, which is interesting.
Rocking a boat.
Did you see that coming?
Hell no. Who would see that coming?
Yeah, I don't know. And the interesting thing is, it's like she didn't not endorsing Markey would seem weird considering what she's said before about primary challenges and how terrible of an idea they are. Sitting it out seems like kind of like a little bit of support for Kennedy, sort of implicitly, that she's not gonna weigh in and try to ward off this challenge. But to actually come out and endorse him seems so needless, unless she thinks it's gonna be really close and he needs a little bit of a boost to win this thing, that she comes in at almost the last minute to endorse him. That seems like if you're Ed Markey, you've got to be just wondering where this dagger came from.
Well, I think, yeah, so we'll see what happens. But I think this is Nancy Pelosi kind of giving her weekend nod to the new way to do politics, because she has held as a philosophy of politics not to do things like this. And the way she has endorsed primary challengers to incumbents is by staying out of the race. Her silence has been deafening. She has now done an about face on that strategy, and you know, this may be the new Nancy.
Maybe. And look, she obviously she can do whatever she wants. She can endorse someone if she wants. And what we've always said at TYT is if you want to launch a primary challenge, you go ahead and you launch that primary challenge and may the best man or woman or whoever win. But we get to break down your record and what it is that's actually motivating a challenge. Okay, so we've had any number of in this cycle, you know, Jamal Bowman just recently, like, you know, just a stone's throw away from the Markey race. And we think we have a pretty good idea of why some of these challenges are running. For me, with Joe Kennedy, I'm sure he's a nice guy. It seems to me like it's just, it's his time. It's a dynasty. He gets to run on his name or whatever. And it's not that Ed Markey isn't doing his job or that he's out of step with his constituents or anything like that. He was just in the way. He was sitting in a chair that Kennedy wanted to sit in. So yeah, I guess, well, this is the new paradigm then.
Yep.
So we don't have to hear any more from Nancy Pelosi or Democratic leadership about how all of these young progressives need to stop challenging their incumbents. The gloves are off, I guess.
It has to be. You can't go back now. You would lose intellectual honesty if you go back and say that what young progressives are doing inside of Democratic primaries is somehow disruptive. Well, it is supposed to be disruptive. And I guess Nancy now has found a new ideology as it relates to politics in DC.
I guess. Yeah, they're all gonna be really worried about coming off as intellectually dishonest.
Yeah.
but I agree with the spirit of what you're saying. Yeah, no, and the reason behind it. Okay, with that, why don't we jump into the DNC? As I said, if you haven't already hit the like button, everybody, please do that. It'd be very helpful. You know, we need to bow down before the algorithm gods and all of that. And with that, let's start talking about last night. Possibly one of, if not the most anticipated speech at the DNC this year for everyone other than me, because I was obviously most excited about AOC. For everyone else, it was going to be former President Barack Obama, not only because he's, you know, still one of the biggest figures in the Democratic Party, still very liked by the American public and known as one of the best living speechmakers in America. So he delivered a speech and it was, I would say, quite different than any speech he's given before. We got a couple different videos. I wanna show you one section of his speech where he talked about what his expectations were for whoever it was that was going to follow him in the White House.
I never expected that my successor would embrace my vision or continue my policies. I did hope, for the sake of our country, that Donald Trump might show some interest in taking the job seriously. That he might come to feel the weight of the office and discover some reverence for the democracy that had been placed in his care. But he never did. For close to 4 years now, he has shown no interest in putting in the work, no interest in finding common ground, no interest in using the awesome power of his office to help anyone but himself and his friends. Donald Trump hasn't grown into the job because he can't. And the consequences of that failure are severe. 170,000 Americans dead. Millions of jobs gone. While those at the top taken more than ever. Our worst impulses unleashed. Our proud reputation around the world badly diminished. And our democratic institutions threatened like never before.
He talks at length in that speech about the threat to American democracy, which I know, like, in recent years, it just seems like, yeah, that's the conversation. Democrats are really worried about Trump, you know, and vice versa. That must be how it's always been. But honestly, like, I mean, if you remember some of the big Obama speeches, including back to 2004, like, he does seem more worried about the future than I think I've ever heard him before. But Rashad, I'm interested in your take.
Yeah, I think President Obama was being authentic. Now, sometimes President Obama, Hillary Clinton, all of these individuals give very political speeches. And these political speeches have some semblance of authenticity. But this one, I think he's all in, man. What you see in President Donald J. Trump is an individual who has figured out something. And he figured out that democracy is actually fragile as long as people are willing to let him do whatever he wants to do. So it is fragile enough to where he also figured out a way to shrink the office of the presidency to meet him rather than expand himself to meet the office institution of the presidency. And that's what Obama, President Obama, was talking about. And I think there was in President Obama and many who, some who even voted for the guy, I think they believed that at some point he would turn off the act and turn on the real. And they didn't realize when they supported him or even when he was the political opposition that the act was the real the whole time. This is exactly who he is, and he is not challenged to be anything more than that.
Yeah, that Trump was indeed as small as we thought he was, if not smaller, as emotional and petulant as we thought he was, if not more emotional and petulant, all of that. And so look, I liked Obama's speech. You know, obviously, there's a lot that I didn't like about the Obama years, some of the things that they did, some of the things that they could have done but did not. And at TYT, we were very critical of that. I like to admit all of my biases to everyone. And so just people need to understand that in terms of like my entree into politics, like I started following politics in 2001 in the weeks following 9/11. That was my first couple of weeks in college. I went through all those rough years. And then there was the Kerry thing. It was a huge disappointment. You have even more terrible years. And then 2004, Obama's speech and the expectation of what he was presenting himself as. So no matter what Obama does, while I can criticize, you know, him on the policy and everything, there's gonna be a part of me that remembers that. And so I'm always gonna be down for an Obama speech. So understand you can have both of those things at the same time.
Yep.
But anyway, yeah, no, I'm glad that he gave that warning. It is not the thing that every former president does. It just isn't. And I do think it's honest. Like we can take some issues maybe with how Obama addressed executive orders and things like that. Every president tries to expand their power, and every president needs to be stopped from doing that. But I think that he's right that this is different. And Trump really does see the office as just a thing. I took a line out of this. Let's see. Treating the presidency as anything but one more reality show that he can use to get the attention he craves while, you know, funneling money to himself and to his friends. That really does seem to be the limit of Donald Trump's interest in the presidency.
Yeah, what's interesting also, and hella ironic, is that all of these conservatives are bent out of shape about a former president daring to say something like this about a sitting president. It has never been done. This is not part of our American way. And they have routinely allowed the current president to break and violate every single protocol known to the presidency and literally known to their party. They used to be the party of family values. At least that's what they said. They were the party of fiscal conservatism. They can't be the party of that anymore because their standard bearer, Donald J. Trump, cannot bear the standard of that particular value system. So what have they done? They have not transformed him. They have instead been transformed by him. And they are now redefined as a Republican Party because of it.
Exactly. Exactly.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Okay, let's turn to a couple of other aspects about this. Last night at the DNC, we not only had Obama, we also had the first big speech of Kamala Harris accepting the nomination. So I want to touch on two different parts of this. The first is where Kamala Harris is talking about some of the history that took us to a place where she could be accepting this nomination. Take a look.
This week marks the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment. And we celebrate the women who fought for that right. Yet so many of the black women who helped secure that victory were still prohibited from voting long after its ratification. But they were undeterred. Without fanfare or recognition, they organized and testified and rallied and marched and fought, not just for their vote, but for a seat at the table. These women and the generations that followed worked to make democracy and opportunity real in the lives of all of us who followed. They paved the way for the trailblazing leadership of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And these women inspired us to pick up the torch and fight on. Women like Mary Church Terrell, Mary Cloyd Bethune, Fannie Lou Hamer, and Diane Nash, Constance Baker Motley, and the great Shirley Chisholm. We're not often taught their stories, but as Americans, we all stand on their shoulders.
Okay, so again, I'll give the caveats just like I did with Obama. Obviously, with Kamala Harris, there are a number of things about her past that I disagree with, and our vision of what needs to happen in the future, obviously different on a few core political issues. That said, I think we can acknowledge that this is obviously a huge thing, and I'm glad that she focused on sort of this long century plus long road to get there. What did you think of her speech?
Yeah, her speech was fine. She's not the most engaging speaker. She's obviously been trained somewhat because I've never seen her smile so much, John. She smiled throughout that entire speech. It was very inviting. I thought she did a great job. She nailed the speech. It's tough to just overwhelm people with the speech, but she did a good job. Let me say this about her candidacy, because I didn't think she would be the number one pick. She was definitely in my top three because she does have some issues with criminal justice reform, her record as a prosecutor. I thought those would be more problematic. Now, here's what they're doing with Senator Harris. Senator Harris is going to be positioned not as a policy candidate, but as a candidate who has a remarkable story of the American dream. This is going to be, based on what we've seen so far, a candidacy and a campaign based on a general expression of America rather than hardcore policy items. Okay, so expect to see more policy from Joe Biden than Senator Harris. And as the race tightens up, and maybe there will be some debates, maybe not, but as the race tightens up, I think some of those policy questions will have to be answered by both candidates, frankly. But yeah. Good job.
Yeah. I thought it was perfectly fine. I think that she's a slightly better than average speaker for a politician. I mean, I'm so used to, like, you know, the Amy Klobuchars and the Ted Cruz. She's better than that. She's no Obama, but you know, who is, honestly, other than like AOC. You know, or Bernie has some good speeches too, obviously. I thought it was good. She had to balance a few different things. She had to introduce herself to a lot of people who weren't necessarily paying attention to the primary. She had to talk about why Biden needed to be elected, while also do a little bit of attacking Donald Trump as well. You know, on the attacking front, actually, why don't we turn to this short video and then we'll give some more commentary about the speech as a whole.
I have fought for children and survivors of sexual assault. I fought against transnational criminal organizations. I took on the biggest banks and helped take down one of the biggest for-profit colleges. I know a predator when I see one.
That's a good line. Now, she didn't, like, that wasn't launching into a minute long section about Trump being a predator, but she said it, and we could probably
she made the
more
point. The shade, the slick shade was noticed.
Exactly. Now, that said, in terms of, like, I try to be, obviously I'm a cynic and I'm a critic and everything, but giving a speech like this in a big empty room is tough for anyone. And so I give a few bonus points to every speaker because that's a difficult environment. Like you've probably done a lot more public speaking than I have. I've only done a few, but like the thing that makes it easiest is an enthusiastic crowd. And at a convention, you're supposed to have that, but they don't get to have that. So I give them a couple bonus points because they're lacking that to help them out.
Yeah, I agree with you. I actually teach, one of the classes I teach at the university is public speaking, and how a big part of public speaking is understanding the response of the audience, that emotional moment where you're looking at facial expressions, you're looking at the eyes rolling or the eyes being attentive, you're looking at smiles, you're looking at laughs. You can't see any of that when you don't have anybody in the room with you, and it's a pre-recorded session. So these are very difficult to pull off. I agree with you. Everyone gets some bonus points for being able to do it and do it as if there are people in front of them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I thought that she did a good job. I know a lot of people in the YouTube comments right now are talking about how smiley she was. I think it's a couple different things. One, she's being nominated to be VP. You can be excited about that.
She's happy.
She's happy. She gets to be happy. Yeah. She does. And she, of course, has to, as an outsider, you just have to acknowledge. Every single black woman in America is going to be presented as angry no matter what in an effort to cast her as someone that you don't have to pay attention to.
Yeah, and Trump has already tried that, right? Trump, initially when it was announced, remember he held the press conference and said, oh, she was just the meanest. She was a mean woman. She was so mean to Joe Biden. And he says these things as if people are supposed to believe that he actually cares about Joe Biden and cares that somebody was mean to Joe Biden. What he was doing was creating the genesis of the narrative that will say, oh, she's an angry black woman, something that has been politicized and used to marginalize black women who really, they run circles around some of these white guys in politics. But that is the way they try to marginalize their effort.
Exactly. Yeah, and so I have no doubt that at least a part of it is trying to fight back against that. But the thing is, they're gonna do it no matter what. You can be as happy and as smiling, as positive as you want. They're gonna try to do it. And even right after that speech, you had was Sarah Palin was on Tucker Carlson, and Tucker Carlson was like, "What would you have had to do to get all this positive press coverage that Kamala gets? Nobody ever criticized her. What would you have to do?" And Sarah Palin responded, "Well, I probably would have had to prostitute myself the way she has." So no, they're gonna slur her no matter what. And again, I disagree with her on a number of policies, but we can acknowledge when some of these criticisms are fundamentally either misogynistic, unfair, disgusting, or racist.
I can't believe they're dragging the Ice Queen back out for a one last hurrah. That showed you how desperate the Trump campaign is to even give any acknowledgement to allow her to come back and be a surrogate. At one point, they had fallen out. I guess they've repaired the relationship. Somebody needs to check her bank account.
Yeah, maybe. Okay, so let's go to a little bit more response to last night's speeches. During Obama's speech, he was very critical of Donald Trump, and rightfully so. Donald Trump's the worst. But Donald Trump was watching, no matter what he will tell you. And even as the speech was going on, he began responding on Twitter, as the most powerful person in the world, of course, would. Tweeting, why did he refuse to endorse Slow Joe until it was all over? And even then was very late. Why did he try to get him not to run? He spied on my campaign and got caught. And with Kamala Harris, but didn't she call him a racist? Didn't she say he was incompetent? And by the way, he retweeted himself this morning, that tweet. He was very happy with the didn't she call him a racist. She didn't call him a racist. She pointed out some of his racial issues, of which Joe Biden does have some. So that was fair to do. And he was so worked up about it, and the fact that some Twitter trends about what Obama had said had been critical of Trump, that this morning he also tweeted, it's never a real Twitter trending. It's Twitter executive's choice. Only negative on Republican voices, especially mine. So he's having a good morning, I think. I think he's doing quite well.
Man, listen, why does your Trump impression sound like Rumpelstiltskin? So that is great though. Okay. Yeah, man, he's having a breakdown, but he has breakdowns routinely where he gets in these Twitter rants and he's talking directly to his fan base that, you know, the red meat he's throwing at them. But it gives you an idea of his state of mind, right? And state of mind is important when you understand a person who's in the position to create policy, to block policy, to emphasize or de-emphasize policy. And you get a clear picture of exactly what's important to him. What's important to him? People that say anything critical of him are his enemy, period. He doesn't care about democracy. He cares about loyalty to him personally. And those who aren't loyal to him, well, there's an enemy list that he creates.
Yeah, 100%. It's all about loyalty. You are, if you are loyal to him, you're great and smart and awesome and first rate and you're the best and you're beautiful. If you turn against him, all of that's not true anymore, even if he just said it the day before. Yeah, and so he obviously freaked out about Obama. Like, we know that Obama has been under his skin for literally years. That's why Trump's life for like 3 years was trying to prove that Obama wasn't an American citizen. And in terms of what Obama pointed out that Trump has done in his speech, Trump this morning responded, there was great lawlessness in the Obama administration. There was tremendous lawlessness. So a little bit of projection to get you going in the morning. Yeah, Trump is very worried about lawlessness. That's what he's worried about.
Right.
About politicians.
Yeah, he's really concerned. Yeah.
This
guy's really concerned about the Constitution. He's concerned about people breaking the law. But everyone who has admitted that they broke the law that are his friends, they get a get out of jail free card and an affirmative defense from the president of the United States. Even if they are charged with trafficking children, they get a defense from the president of the United States. But he's the law.
The thing that is supposed to get all those Q people against you. No, he can say something nice about Ghislaine Maxwell. He can do that. Yeah, you either get a literal get out of jail free card, like for Roger Stone, or you get a get out of I ever knew you card. You pretend, I never met that guy. I don't know anything about him. And we got one of those stories coming on later today, actually. So yeah, that was one little freak out he had. I can only imagine if Biden is very critical of him tonight, he's gonna lose it once again. Tough times for the president.
Yeah, and I think Biden should be critical and just watch Trump dissolve. But listen, John, I want to say this before we move on. After Joe Biden gives his speech, I pray to the executives of the Democratic Party, put Joe Biden in a cave until the election day. Okay, only Joe Biden can lose this election. Only Joe Biden can beat the Biden-Harris ticket. Okay.
I agree. I know, and it's a terrible thing to have to advocate for to be in that position, but I'm gonna be watching his speech tonight worried a little bit. And we'll see. And the thing is, honestly, in terms of his speech and in terms of his debate performance, we are so worried, and there's been so much talk, especially by Trump, about how bad he's gonna be. It also sort of serves to lower the bar too. That if he gives a halfway decent speech, it's probably gonna seem pretty good in comparison to what we expected, but we'll have to see. I just wanna briefly mention one other thing. We don't have to go at length, but last night during the DNC, there were a number of different topical focuses. So you had a section about the environment. You also had a section about gun violence and about domestic violence too. And so at one point, they're going on about what Joe Biden has done about domestic violence. And they're talking about the experiences of individuals. And I swear to God, while that segment is going on, Mike Pompeo tweets this. Take a look. Yeah, so it's Lisa Simpson ripping up papers and sobbing. Oh, I get it. He's being like an online right winger. You know, he's doing a meme and it's like he's getting the libs because they're crying about domestic violence. And how for hundreds of years, actually, I guess outside of the United States, thousands of years, you've just been able to do whatever you want to any woman you're with. Beat them. It's not a crime. It's a private matter. You can get away with it. And how it took so long for us to finally, as a country, start to take it more seriously. Still in a horrible situation legally. He has the crying going on. And Hayes Brown of BuzzFeed tweeted this, because Mike Pompeo has actually done this before, not seeming to get what that shot of Lisa Simpson's from. This is from the episode where Lisa sees a politician take a bribe and tears up her speech about American exceptionalism in anguish that the country she loves is actually rife with corruption at the top. So it's sort of perfect that you have this extremely powerful government figure mocking the Democrats for caring about domestic violence, that is how he uses his Twitter account, that this is how Republicans do, that it's all just trolling now. It's all just memes and trying to own people and trying to trigger the libs. Doesn't matter how serious the content is, doesn't matter how great the responsibility and the challenges that we face are. this is what they're going to approach it with, is with screenshots of The Simpsons.
It's so damn sad. Man, you have to laugh not to cry sometimes. But realize this, John, and I know everybody watching, they understand it as well. This is part of what makes the rape culture a reality in America. It's sentiment like that from individuals that you and I would believe are learned, are cultured, and have some level of understanding about why these sensitivities are real and why these issues are relevant. But they don't. Why? Because they have become tribal in their political reality, where right and wrong is no longer decided. It's simply what side you're on or not.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, remember that. So this is how they mock discussion of the topic, but they have equally horrific positions on the actual issues. So yeah. If you have if you've been charged or arrested with beating your spouse or your girlfriend, they want you to still be able to have a gun. They don't want any states to even temporarily take away your weapons, even though we know possibly the greatest predictor of spouse murder is previous domestic violence. No, they want the guy to have a gun because they value possession of guns more than the lives of women. They believe that spousal rape isn't a thing. She's your property. You can do whatever you want. This is what they actually believe. So sure, on Twitter, it's shots of Lisa Simpson, but in the halls of Congress and state government, it's doing whatever is necessary to maintain male primacy in terms of legal rights. You can do whatever you want so long as they maintain power. Donald Trump has, over the last few months, given a wink and a nod to QAnon any number of times. But for the first time yesterday, he was actually asked about it in a press conference. And here's what he had to say.
During the pandemic, the QAnon movement appears to be gaining a lot of followers. Can you talk about what you think about that and what you have to say to people who are following this movement right now?
Well, I don't know much about the movement other than I understand they like me very much. Which I appreciate, but I don't know much about the movement. I have heard that it is gaining in popularity, and from what I hear, these are people that, when they watch the streets of Portland, when they watch what happened in New York City in just the last 6 or 7 months, but this was starting even 4 years ago when I came here, almost 4 years, can you believe it? These are people that don't like seeing what's going on in places like Portland and places like Chicago and New York and other cities and states. And I've heard these are people that love our country and they just don't like seeing it. So I don't know really anything about it other than they do supposedly like me. And they also would like to see problems in these areas, like especially the areas that we're talking about, go away because.
Yeah. Okay. So the only thing he's heard is that they like me. That's it. Nothing else. You know what? I'm just going to get mad if I can't take the QAnon stuff. Rashad, what do you think about what happened yesterday? Him doing this?
All right. Number one. So we know the code now, right? Here's the code. When Trump says it is, it isn't. When Trump says it isn't, it is. That's the code, not hard to figure out. So when he came out and said, I don't know much about these people. I know they like me. I don't know much about them. And then, John, he proceeds to tell the reporter more about QAnon than she knew. Okay? So he starts going down this whole explanation about what they've done and what they stand for. But remember, he doesn't know anything about them. I'm starting to believe that he is QAnon. I think he's the guy, right? He's behind the whole thing in some manner, right? Now, remember, this extreme right-wing conspiracy theorist group, they have said some of the most egregious things about black people, Jews. They have this sentiment known as the deep state, as if there's just, you know, this group of dark forces inside of the American government trying to get their beloved president. And anything that the president does wrong is because of the deep state and not because of Trump. But they got people that support them who are now major candidates for the US Congress. We have one in the 14th Congressional District in Georgia supported QAnon. She won her primary against the medical doctor. And she will, 90%, she will win in the general election. And she's not the only one.
Exactly. Yeah. Again, it's a pandemic. The person who thinks that you get coronavirus because demons from the moon give it to you beat a doctor. So that's good. That's the state of America. Yep. Yeah. And so look, I got more I want to say, but we got one more little bit of video on he wanted to imply that he doesn't know anything about QAnon, even though, as Rashad points out, he then cited all the things that he says he knows. So he doesn't know any of the crazy stuff. So the reporter brings up some of the crazy.
Theory is this belief that you are secretly saving the world from this satanic cult of pedophiles and cannibals. Does that sound like something you are behind?
Well, I haven't heard that, but is that supposed to be a bad thing or a good thing? I mean, you know, if I can help save the world from problems, I'm willing to do it. I'm willing to put myself out there. And we are, actually. We're saving the world from a radical left philosophy that will destroy this country. And when this country is gone, the rest of the world would follow. The rest of the world would follow.
Okay, so he's asked about the fact that he's supposed to be fighting against a centuries old bipartisan group of satanic pedophiles who sell kids on Wayfair and drink their hormones while cutting off their face and putting the kid's face and putting it on their face and having sex with them. These are things that they believe, and he turns it into, they're just worried about problems. And then most dangerously, because I know a lot of people think that this is just funny or whatever, he then says they just want the problems to be fixed. And he transitions immediately to, these are the left's problems that I'm fixing. So that satanic pedophile stuff that I know we think is funny, but that they think is 100% serious, the president just stood on TV and identified that as a left problem. And so when you have QAnon adherents committing acts of violence and terrorism, as they already have and will continue to do, the president has just pointed them at Democrats and the left and said, those are the people that I'm protecting you from. And they're trying to take down America. And when they take down America, they're going to take down the entire world. That is what he said when he was asked a question about possibly the craziest conspiracy theory presently being followed and being followed by more and more people every single day.
This is such a job for Black Jesus. I don't know what to say about the president of the United States saying something that egregious. Remember, QAnon, and let's just take it out of the extreme theories, right? Because there are people that really believe this stuff. Let's take it away from that conversation just for a moment. Last year, the FBI listed QAnon as an anti-government organization that has, through their own rhetoric, created and incited acts of violence. Just leave it there. You don't have to go anywhere else. The president of the United States, the guy in charge of it all, didn't even mention that his own FBI considers them to be a threat in the United States of America.
Yeah, but it works out perfectly, because I remember when Donald Trump was going to be sworn in as president. I remember thinking, so how exactly does this explicitly anti-government movement, how do they transition to now we're in charge of everything? And the answer was quickly came out within weeks. It was, oh, the deep state. I forget. Before they were outside of government fighting the government. Now they're in government, but still fighting the government. And that's the thing fundamentally about QAnon that frustrates me so much. It's that it really is the ultimate example of a trend that I think has been true for some time, which is people don't like inconvenient information. They're very anxious. They just want to believe good things. And this is a movement that, for all the specifics about pedophiles and Wayfair and Q drops and whatever, fundamentally it's whatever you want to believe is true is true. That's all it is. And so when Q says in his first drop years ago, said Hillary's going to be arrested tomorrow, the National Guard's being called up, that felt good for them to believe. And so they believed it. And when it turned out not to be true the next day, they didn't care and they just moved on. When the Mueller report looked like it was going to be bad for Trump, they wanted to believe that it wasn't. So they believed, as QAnon people did, that Trump was working with Robert Mueller to weed out the pedophiles. And when Trump says he's mad about the investigation, that's just a smokescreen. So they believe that. They believe even now that Hillary Clinton is either arrested or dead. and that the person you're seeing is a body double or a hologram. They believe that for multiple people, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And they believe, so think about that, simultaneously believing everyone I don't like is not just wrong, but they've all committed criminal acts. They're gonna be arrested, or they've already been arrested. And I know that some people believe that they're not because we see them walking around, but it makes me feel better to believe that all these people are either locked up or dead. There are millions of Americans who this is how they approach politics and news now.
John, this is what happens when you get your news from Alex Jones. Bottom line, these fringe elements, right? They're dangerous because of this. Here's why they're really dangerous. Not because they think differently than other people. They're dangerous because they contextualize everyone else who's not them as somehow being evil, not human. They then spin a narrative that says that if these individuals are evil or not human, you can do whatever you want to do to them because they're evil and not human. That is the danger of their ideology, not just because it's different, but because it marginalizes the opposition in such a way that dehumanizes them at their core.
Yeah, you don't have to respect people, and you never, ever, ever have to, even for a second, consider something that makes you uncomfortable, some truth or reality that isn't exactly what you'd want it to believe. And so, you know, just to throw it out again, because maybe there's a couple of people that believe that, like, you know, QAnon, it's totally accurate. You're like, sure, there's some crazies, but it's totally accurate. No, they said when the lockdown started that the reason the lockdowns were happening was not coronavirus. It was that Trump needed all of the pedophiles and Satanists to be at home so that he could mass arrest them. And that was why the lockdown was happening. So what happened to that? What happened to that prediction? It didn't actually happen, and that's not why the lockdown was happening. Has anyone left the QAnon movement because of that, again, horribly mistaken and obviously false prediction? No, because the fundamental element, again, is that you don't have to have an inconvenient thought. And so anything that you thought was true that turns out not to be true, don't think about that. That'll make you uncomfortable. That'll cause painful cognitive dissonance. And the whole point is to avoid that. Anyway, sorry, I get so angry thinking about
me too,
this
man. I feel your pain, brother. I feel your pain 100%, John. But like, you know, Michelle Obama said, it is what it is.
It is what it is. It is what it is. And we have to somehow try to fix the country when more and more Americans are immune to persuasion and immune to facts and fundamentally don't care if what they believe is true. They don't. They just want it to be comfortable. Okay, so let's transition to the sort of second element of this. One of the ways that QAnon has spread so rapidly is that they organize on social media. And it's been very easy to proliferate information about this on things like YouTube and Instagram and Twitter and Snapchat and all of that. Well, Facebook is, at least they say, fighting back against this now. And so they say in a statement, today we are taking action against Facebook pages, groups and Instagram accounts tied to offline anarchist groups that support violent acts amidst protests, US-based militia organizations, and QAnon. While we will allow people to post content that supports these movements and groups, so long as they do not otherwise violate our content policies, we will restrict their ability to organize on our platform. They say that they're gonna derank and limit algorithmic recommendations for QAnon pages, groups, and accounts, remove those that discuss potential violence, and ban QAnon ads and fundraising efforts altogether. And they say that so far they've removed more than 790 groups, 100 pages, and 1500 ads tied to QAnon, blocked more than 300 hashtags. Well, stay on it because they're gonna get new ones in minutes. And impose restrictions on more than about 2000 groups and 440 pages on Facebook and more than 10,000 accounts on Instagram. Remember, followed by millions of people. And so, Rashad, do you think, like, how big of a move is this? Is it gonna stick? What do you think about Facebook finally taking this seriously?
Well, first of all, Facebook needs to get it together. I can't believe they're bragging about those numbers. All right, 1500, 700 this, 1500 that. You're talking about millions of followers. You're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people tweeting this stuff or putting this stuff on Facebook and then sharing it and then going to their communities talking about it as if it's real. They are simply chasing their tail if they think this is the way to do it. You can't give groups like this that have an exact agenda to do exactly what they're doing. They will only reform and reformulate the strategy. That is mm-hmm. it. Unless Facebook actually gets real serious and they eradicate this altogether. Right now, they're still playing games, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, look, banning those groups makes sense. But with Facebook, anything coming, anything having to do with disinformation and especially politics, I fundamentally don't trust them. And we need years of them doing the right thing for me to fundamentally change that view. I mean, we know what they did in the run up to 2016, how much they've resisted any actual reform since then. They're still routinely allowing Donald Trump to lie in his campaign ads because it's to their financial benefit. Right. They're meeting with members of the Trump team. So, okay, you banned some groups. We'll see in a week. We'll see in a month.
But here's what's going to happen, John. If they don't do something now, this guy who's currently the leader of the free world, he's not going to always be the leader. The individuals who are in charge of the Senate will not always be in charge of the Senate. If they don't figure out a way to self-regulate and do a better job at it, when leadership transforms or transitions, they will be on the chopping block. Their industry will be severely regulated by law and by mandate rather than by volunteerism. And so they have a choice to make. Either get it right now or wait for the leadership change and they will get it right for you. Because the American people are getting tired of it. The vast majority of Americans polled about this, they are tired of lies on social media. It's the sentiment of the country. It's the sentiment of many elected officials. And it is the sentiment of those who are emerging to the ranks of power in this country.
Yeah. What a terrible time we live in every possible way. Against all odds, there were still a couple of people that had worked for Donald Trump that weren't yet in federal prison, but we're getting closer to one today with Steve Bannon being arrested. New York federal prosecutors on Thursday charged President Donald Trump's former campaign advisor, Steve Bannon, and three others with defrauding donors of hundreds of thousands of dollars as part of a fundraising campaign purportedly aimed at supporting Trump's border wall. Bannon, Colfage, Andrew Badalato, and Timothy Shea are charged with one count of conspiracy to commit wire fraud and one count of conspiracy to commit money laundering. And this is obviously sort of inconvenient for the right, although Trump doesn't like Steve Bannon, so that makes it a little bit easier on them. But that said, it was being discussed on Fox News earlier. Here's a little bit of Andrew Napolitano talking about why it's potentially so serious for Steve Bannon and his accomplices.
Entity We Build the Wall promised its donors that not a penny, quote, not a penny would go into their pockets. So rather than putting the money directly into their pockets, they funneled it to third party charities, and those charities paid the money, according to the indictment, to Steve Bannon and to the others. In Bannon's case, obviously the person that is most of interest to our viewers because of his former relationship to the president. In Bannon's case, the government alleges and the indictment charges him with receipt of over $1 million. And then the use of the third party charities to actually pay them so as to hide the payments from the donors and presumably from the government is an effort to cover your trail because they knew they had misled the donors. It doesn't look good for him right now.
So that's a good point. The fact that they funneled it through these groups makes it pretty clear that they knew what they were doing and taking all these hundreds of thousands of dollars and then stealing it. They didn't do it directly. They tried to hide it. They just apparently were incompetent in that effort.
Yeah, this goes to show you, this is proof positive, John, that even Steve Bannon realized that the whole wall thing was a con. Okay, so here's Steve Bannon saying, you know what? Let me get in on this con, because obviously the president is not going to actually build a wall. He doesn't have the approval, but he's going to keep saying he will. So Bannon jumped in on this, knowing the money would never go to that because it's not happening, right? And he admitted in his action that the entire wall thing is an actual con. So he's going to the pokey. Good for him.
Exactly. Yeah, there were so few left on the outside. So few wild former Trump staffers.
Yeah, I thought he would have been the first, by the way. So I'm surprised it took this long.
Yeah. You really would have thought so. You know, I want to jump to one or two more little details about that. So, Skip, I'm going to jump to this tweet. Evan Hill got a little bit of information from the Bannon indictment. Someone apparently used border wall money to buy themselves a nice little pleasure craft named Warfighter that they're about to lose. And we, in fact, have a picture of the boat that some of this wall money was spent on. So there's Warfighter. And what's most amazing is that that boat was one of the boats in the Trump boat parade on the 4th of July that Trump still talks about to this day, about how great it was to see all those pro-Trump boats. One of those was intended to buy a few bricks for his wall, but it instead went to a tiny little yacht.
You know, I wonder how Trump feels about this, right? So here's the test for any conservative that still believes in Trump, okay? If Trump was authentic and sincere about building a wall for you, because that was important, I guess. If he was sincere in that belief and in that effort, then he should be holding a press conference right now about how appalled he is that his friend or ex-friend Steve Bannon defrauded the American people, right? Yep. Because that money was supposed to go for the wall that I said I would build. And then he can use it as an excuse, John, and say, and you know what? Because of this, I'm unable to build the wall. All the money was tied up with Steve Bannon. All the money was with Steve, yeah.
That's a good idea. He has not done that. So initially, the White House Director of Strategic Communications declined a comment. That was early this morning. But Trump has commented, actually. So he said, I feel very badly. I haven't been dealing with him for a long period of time. I know nothing about the project. And you'll be shocked to find out that that's not true. The thing Trump said this morning isn't true.
Remember the quote, John. If he says it is,
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Okay. But we've also brought some receipts to prove the code is true. Chris Kobach back in on January 25th of 2019 said, the president said the project has my blessing and you can tell the media that. So according to Chris Kobach, Trump not only knew about the project, but thought it was awesome. And they had to put out a statement. Trump org spokeswoman Amanda Miller had to put out a statement because Donald Trump Jr. went to a spot to give a speech for that group about how they were gonna help build the wall. So he doesn't know anything about it. His son's just going and speaking to them and he's talked about how awesome it is. And let's just summarize. A former campaign manager ripped off the president's supporters claiming to fulfill a campaign promise that Trump couldn't do himself. That should probably hurt Trump a little bit.
Yeah, it should. And the fact that Trump basically endorsed the program as well as his son. Now I'm wondering, John, did the son get paid to make that speech from those same funds? Was there some type of contribution given to either the Trump campaign or one of the Trump political action committees for the involvement of his son or for the endorsement of Trump? I see this not being the end. I see this as the beginning, because when you're talking about this kind of money and this kind of scheme, that's endorsed by this level of person, by the president and the president's son, I think you're going to see more people named in the future. And I think you're going to see a larger conspiracy.
Perhaps. I mean, I have no doubt that Don Jr. got paid. I mean, that's what he's in all of this for. Whether that opens him up to any liability, I don't know. It could be that he had no idea about what was happening, but maybe we'll see. The thing is, this could hurt Trump maybe, but probably not, because his fans, you know, believe in lizard people and
right. Well, it won't hurt the 30%. You know, this guy's going to always have 33% of his base. But you do see Republicans, conservatives, more of the mainstream cloth guys, they're stepping away from him.
Yeah, that's true. But someone who it could potentially hurt, Philip Bump had a great tweet saying Trump's first 2016 campaign manager was arrested for battery after grabbing a reporter in 2016. His second campaign manager went to prison on a variety of federal charges stemming from the Mueller probe. His third campaign manager was just indicted on federal fraud charges. Brad Parscale, you better run or hide. I don't know, whichever you think will work better for you.
It is not looking good. At all. You know, in my neighborhood, John, we played a lot of basketball, right? And we had a term called self-check. And that's when the person who has the basketball is so bad at what they do, they're bad at playing, that you don't have to check them. You don't have to guard them. Trump is in ultimate self-check mode right now. Biden doesn't really need to say much. Senator Harris doesn't need to say much. Trump just needs to keep talking and tweeting. Yeah. He's in self-check mode and he has defeated his own presidency.
That's pretty good. I like that. Okay, with that, let's turn back to one or two other little crises that we're currently facing as a country. Oh, this is gonna be a rough one. Okay. Wait, I'm not seeing. There we go. Yes. Awesome. Okay. So as of right now, despite the fact that we have already seen multiple schools being shut down after coronavirus has spread through both the student population as well as the teacher population, as a government, Trump's administration is still pushing for it to happen. And so here is Kayleigh McEnany talking about why it remains such a priority for them.
For the United Federation of Teachers, he's saying teachers don't feel safe. They want every student to be tested when they walk through the door of their schools. Can the president promise that that will eventually be a possibility? Will we have testing capacity to test kids before they go back to school? How does the president respond to that? The teachers not wanting to, they're threatening a walkout or a sick out.
Look, we believe teachers are essential workers. The media never stopped working during this pandemic. Our meat packers didn't stop working during this pandemic. Our law enforcement didn't stop working during this pandemic, nor should our teachers.
Okay, so the teachers need to keep working because other essential personnel like meatpacking plant workers had to work. But the meatpacking plant workers didn't have to work because the country was about to fall apart, like with the nurses. They had to work because they were going to be imminently fired by their companies if they didn't. They were forced at the threat of economic devastation to continue working. And let's bear in mind, as we have many times through the course of this pandemic, that it costs them significantly. Take a look at this. At least 20% of US meatpackers may have contracted coronavirus. You have meatpacking companies dismissed years of warnings, but now say that nobody could have prepared for COVID-19. So the many that died and the many that got cases, nothing could have been done, even though they had been warned about the spread of disease. And you have COVID-19 sweeping through Wisconsin food plants still, with the workers saying, please do something. So they have wanted help the entire time, but they haven't gotten it. So that's with the meatpacking plant workers. Now the teachers are saying, and have been in advance of going back, this is a horrible idea. And she is saying, Kayleigh McEnany is saying, no. All those lessons that we learned, the obvious lessons about how this is gonna be devastating, we're not going to learn anything from those. And we're gonna have teachers dying at similar rates to meatpacking plant workers. And if that kills a few hundred, a few thousand teachers, that is a price that Kayleigh McEnany and the Trump administration is willing to pay.
Yeah, it is a political position rather than a position rooted in decency and science. I was a foster kid, John. My mom is a school teacher. She was a school teacher when she adopted me. You're talking about some of the most remarkable people on the planet Earth. They don't make a ton of money. They're well educated. They don't make a ton of money. They could do other things and they choose to serve in this way, right? When teachers are saying you're not creating an environment that's safe for children, you're not creating an environment that's safe for the teaching moment to take place, the administration should have taken that seriously. They have not. This will end up creating more COVID-19 cases. Remember, we're 5% of the global population, but 25% of the coronavirus cases on the planet. That should tell you everything you need to know about how we have handled this pandemic in America.
Yeah, it's just devastating, the numbers. And I saw, this is something we mentioned like a week ago, but he's still doing it. Trump was again slamming New Zealand for their huge spike in cases, as he says. And he specifically said, he like totally summarized an argument that we've been making, that we've been saying he would make earlier on the show, that he would claim that it's fine that we're doing poorly with coronavirus because other countries are. And he said that New Zealand is failing in the same way. New Zealand had 9 cases on Monday of this week. They have 93 total cases diagnosed of people who are currently dealing with coronavirus. Across the entire of their country, less than 100 people have it right now. And he's saying that is why it's okay that we lost 1,400 people in the last daily report of coronavirus deaths.
He's ridiculous. He's ridiculous. And he's using statistical data to try to make the numbers seem manageable and better than what they are. Remember, he's a binary guy, right? He engages in what we call binary marketing. Everything with him is a win or a loss. So yeah, There's no gray area that he really argues, right? So he either will say, no. It is totally 100% great, fine, and dandy. Or he says that it's the worst, absolute disaster, etc. Now, here's the truth. The truth is, there are some spots in America, they have done better, but that's because of the governor. That's because of local governments, right? Not because of leadership from the federal government, but overall as a country, if we're really the United States of America, the president speaks overall as the leader of the country. The country is not doing well. We're doing worse. And anyone who dares to say the truth from his administration, they immediately get their hand slapped by this president.
Yeah. Yeah, it's about winning versus losing, loyal versus disloyal. It is very, like, you're 100% right. It is entirely binary. Everything is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, and it's unfortunately it's costing so many people lives. And the thing is, like, we're never gonna get those people back, but the last thing we can hope to do is to try to stop new groups from being decimated in the same way. And people have been trying to do that with teachers, and unfortunately it looks like a lot of schools are still going to try it out, and it's going to fail, as it has in so many places already.
Every single one of those schools, every single one of them will fail. Okay, I'm saying that now. I've had conversations with superintendents of schools throughout the state of Georgia. I'm friends with some of them. Some of them are under immense pressure by their elected board of education representatives to start school back, because once again, they are coming at this from a place of partisanship. It is political for them rather than from a place of science and health.
We haven't yet on the show covered this former DHS chief of staff who's been going around and talking about some of the experiences that he had with Donald Trump while he was still serving in government. There is one that I want to focus on, though, and this is when this individual, Miles Taylor, was speaking recently with Hallie Jackson.
There was a time when, of course, we were spending a lot of our days down in Puerto Rico after the hurricanes wreaked devastation down there, U.S. Virgin Islands, and other places. There was a trip that we made down there in August of 2018, and I remember before we went, the president said something, and your viewers are going to be somewhat familiar with this. The president's talked before about wanting to purchase Greenland, but one time before we went down, he told us not only did he want to purchase Greenland, he actually said he wanted to see if we could sell Puerto Rico. Could we swap Puerto Rico for Greenland? Because in his words, Puerto Rico was dirty and the people were poor. And these
you don't
are the
think
thoughts
it was a
he
joke?
Has
when
you didn't
Americans
are in
way?
Danger and recovering. I did not take it as a joke. And on multiple occasions, the president expressed interest in buying Greenland. And I'll go even further about Puerto Rico. The president expressed deep animus towards the Puerto Rican people behind the scenes.
Yeah, and so that certainly is something that we were familiar with beforehand, and we'd heard some of this stuff. Obviously, you know, he hated Puerto Rico. That was very clear. He didn't care how many people died, and in fact, about 3,000 people died during that catastrophe. And we know that he wanted to get Greenland as a part of the United States because he doesn't know anything about it, and he thinks that that's a thing that we still do in the world. But the idea that he wanted to directly trade one for the other, that was new information to me, Rashad.
Yeah, the specific information was new, but the sentiment was not. So while, you know, we're saying he did this thing behind the scenes and he felt like this behind the scenes, he felt like this in front of the scenes. If you remember when he went to Puerto Rico, and by the way, he went to Puerto Rico because everybody was telling him, you got to go to Puerto Rico. You have to go to Puerto Rico. So he goes to Puerto Rico. These people are injured, they're dying, they're devastated. And he figures, this is a great time to start throwing paper towels. Mm-hmm. And making light of the situation.
Yeah.
Completely non-presidential. But it lets you know where his heart is at. I promise you this. If he went to a white conservative town that had been devastated by some storm, the last thing this president would do is start throwing towels at them, throwing paper towels at them, and making light of the situation. Because that's his crew, right? He has never been interested in governing the United States of America. He's never been interested in governing for all citizens. He's only been interested in governing the base of people that stick with him.
Yeah, I think you're right, certainly. And that's why this, I think, is important to focus on. I know some people will say, okay, so he said this crazy thing. Why are you focusing on this? It was a few years ago. Okay, that may be true. But do you believe that he has changed since then? If Puerto Rico gets devastated by another hurricane, and we're in hurricane season right now, what, is he gonna care more than he did back in 2017? Is he gonna give more resources? Is he gonna prioritize it more? Who actually thinks that? This same fundamentally racist individual is going to approach the issues having to do with natural disasters from a racist point of view. And so that's an issue that we need to get people focused on so that hopefully it won't be as devastating the next time. And the only thing I disagree with you a little bit is, that while obviously he will provide the resources more to people who look like himself. I mean, we already had that with Texas being hit by a hurricane. They got some resources, Puerto Rico did not. In terms of his actual ability to show empathy, I mean, Stephen Colbert actually made a book out of his commentary on location after, I think it was on the East Coast, it was some hurricane. And he just goes around saying, whose boat is that boat? Is that your boat? Like, he doesn't know how to
provide
empathy to people who've lost everything.
Yeah, he can't connect, man. I don't know if he has a soul or not, but if he does, it's untraceable. One of the things about Biden's first major interview, while I have my issues with Biden on some policy matters, I was reminded during Biden's first interview that this is what having a soul looks like.
Yeah.
Okay. And that is what we have desperately been lacking in the presidency.
Yeah, we definitely have. And obviously, look, it's not like some dichotomy where it's like, you know, if Joe Biden doesn't tweet, then we're good. No, obviously we need the focus on policy and actually addressing issues too. But you can care about those things. You can care about, you know, this ridiculous approach to the world, especially when it so often seems to directly contribute to so much human suffering, as it did in the instance having to do with Maria. With the DNC going on this week, we're finding a little bit more through these speeches about what Joe Biden and Kamala Harris would like to do as president and vice president. But remember that behind the scenes and sort of working in tandem, you also have the Democratic Party working on their platform. So what's in it, what's not in it, and should different representatives and senators actually support it? We're gonna be joined now by one who is voting against that platform. Joining us once again on the show, Congressman Ro Khanna, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me back.
Very glad to have you on, always. You announced about a week ago, and you wrote an op-ed about why you wouldn't be supporting that platform. Can you summarize some of your main points?
It's simple, millions of people are losing their jobs. They shouldn't lose healthcare. If there's any time where we should realize that your dignity, your ability to get basic healthcare should be connected to what job you have, it's now in the midst of the pandemic. And what I'm saying is we need to go back to our roots. This was part of our party platform, Medicare for everyone, up till 1980, up till the Reagan Revolution stripped it. We need to go back and stand for that as a party.
Wow, you know, I actually had not known that it was part of the formal platform up until then. It would be interesting to speculate about what happened in the party between that time period and change that. When you come out with the decision to not support the party platform, are you worried about and have you experienced any strike back from the party?
Well, just a brief history. I mean, Ted Kennedy proposed single payer and expanding Medicare for all in 72. Carter ran on it in 76. Mm-hmm. In fact, the irony is Carter had to take the position of expanding Medicare to get labor on board. The AFL-CIO wasn't going to support Carter if he didn't do that, and he won. So this idea that you can't win on Medicare for all is just wrong. And that Ted Kennedy's whole 1980 primary challenge was over the fact that Carter didn't deliver on Medicare for all, and it was stripped largely because of fear of the Reagan Revolution. So I think the history is important to realize that what we're asking for is not something very new. We're just asking to go back to what the platform was from FDR and Truman. But to your point, yes, you know, I mean, you do face some blowback. And if you're simply a careerist and simply want to score points with people in charge, then it's probably best to not ruffle feathers. But my view is, in the long run, if you stand for conviction, people respect that.
So I have my views, obviously, about the platform, how it's drafted, who has influenced. But as someone who's much more obviously involved in this, I'm curious about the mismatch that could have resulted. Let's say that the party had included a call for Medicare for all, but obviously the nominee does not support Medicare for all. In fact, he said in at least one interview that if it came to his desk, he would veto it. So he's against it as much as a president could potentially be. Do you think that that might have been part of the decision to not include it, that the party needs to appear to be in step in terms of its policy priorities with the nominee?
That could have been, but I think that's a mistake. I don't think that one person should define an entire party. I feel the same way if Bernie Sanders had won the nomination. I think the party should stand for basic things. Medicare for all should be part of what we stand for. If a candidate wins the nomination and disagrees with part of the platform, that's their right. I never have said that Joe Biden needs to adopt Medicare for all as his campaign platform. He won the primary. We lost the primary. He's entitled to run on whatever he sees as his vision. But that shouldn't bind the millions of people who are Democrats who overwhelmingly won Medicare for all. And we should have a strong, robust party platform and then allow candidates to say, here's where I agree and here's where I disagree.
And you know, since you published your op-ed through Common Dreams about your decision, we've had another sort of mismatch between the platform and the nominee. And that is that the platform committee has decided to drop its pledge to end fossil fuel subsidies, which seems like an insane decision to make considering all the activism that's been done around climate change in the past few years. But in response to that, the Biden campaign has come out and said that they still support the dropping of those subsidies. Why then would the party decide to change its mind on that?
That is mind-boggling to me. I mean, I can't imagine that polls doesn't poll 90 to 10. I mean, who wants to have US taxpayer dollars subsidizing fossil fuels? What we ought to be doing is subsidizing clean energy, because there's no price factored in of carbon right now. So I think these are lobbyist interests and old guard interests that still have sway in our party, and it's hurting us. It's hurting our populist appeal. I mean, the irony is we're going to get attacked as being against oil and gas by Trump anyway, so we might as well get the benefit of being for a new vision and a vision that supports clean energy. But to be in a no man's land is where the platform is ending up.
Yeah, Biden is being attacked by Trump as a far left radical, like in the pocket of AOC and Antifa. So he should feel free to do anything he wants. And this is not a surprise. We were predicting this during the race when one of the attacks against Bernie Sanders was he will be tarred as a socialist. No, that's what they do to everyone. If it was Pete Buttigieg, he would be a radical socialist too at this point, at least according to them.
Yeah, I don't understand, because they do that to any one of our nominees. So any one of our nominees is going to have to fight that, which are often lies, but they're going to have to fight that. But so you might as well then get the benefit of mobilizing our base and doing things for people. So you could say, okay, yeah, but you're going to get healthcare, you're going to get a free college, and this socialism stuff is ridiculous. I'm not a socialist. But instead, we just say the socialism stuff is ridiculous, and we don't have the affirmative part. So it seems to me just bad politics.
And you know, all of this is going on during the DNC. You know, I've only been to one, the last one in 2016. This is obviously a very different event. As you've been watching it, do you think that is it accomplishing its goals? Is it doing what it can considering the terrible circumstances?
Well, I think some of it has been very good. I mean, I think the personal testimonials from individuals have been good. I thought the way they did the roll call was good. I thought Obama's speech was very compelling, and Kamala's personal story was compelling. But I think we need to have more of a policy agenda, in my view. Ultimately, policy does matter. And what is our vision for the future? And what are a few specifics? I think the calculation is to appeal to people on an emotional level and a spiritual level. And that's all good. That's necessary, but I don't think it's sufficient. We have to talk about meat and potatoes. How are we going to specifically improve people's lives who've been left behind, who've been upset at the system for the last 20 years? What are we going to do for them?
And you know, obviously, I'm excited to see what's going to end up happening with Biden's speech. I'm sure you'll be watching along as well. Pretty high stakes. We know that Trump's going to reply in real time, so we'll see how that goes. To turn to breaking news, the stance of the Democratic Party in a lot of different ways over the last few years has been quite against primary challengers for the most part. It's been implied to hurt party unity. It's a waste of money. People working with some of these primary challengers has been blacklisted by, I believe, the DCCC. And so very against these primary challengers, which is why I was so surprised this morning when Nancy Pelosi announced that she was going to be endorsing Joe Kennedy in his primary challenge against sitting Democratic Senator Ed Markey. I saw that you had tweeted about it. You seemed to be surprised as well.
Yeah, it was shocking. I mean, when I ran against Mike Condon, incumbent, Both times Pelosi endorsed against me. When AOC ran, she endorsed against AOC. She's endorsed against every against Cori Bush. Her policy is to just support the incumbent, and she's known Markey for many years. He was an incumbent in the House, so I do think it's a bit hypocritical. But I think it's going to backfire. You know, Markey's been running against a dynastic politics. He's been running against establishment-based politics, and I think he's come off as the underdog and up fighting for the little guy, and that's winning. So I actually think this just helps his narrative.
Yeah, we'll have to see if some massive fundraising surge comes out of this. But one of the reasons that it bothered me, not just because it lays bare the hypocrisy, and I know that Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is tweeting about that, but that also timing-wise, Nancy Pelosi, Representative Pelosi, her state is on fire. Like, there are fires miles away from where I'm sitting right now. And so it's just great symbolism that she is breaking this seeming precedent that she has to endorse a guy who's up until very recently had investments in fossil fuels against Ed Markey, who is among the top leaders in elected office on trying to combat climate change. It's such a weird move, and I wonder, does it signal a change in the approach to these progressive challengers, that perhaps there's been too much progress and they feel like they need to get a little bit more aggressive against them? I don't know, but I certainly don't like the imagery when California is currently burning.
Yeah, I think it's just there's probably some longstanding relationship there between the Pelosi family and the Kennedy family, and Kennedy's calling in all his chips. I do think it shows that Ed Markey's in a strong position. I mean, he probably had to cash in a lot of chips to get the speaker to weigh in a race like this. I won't look at it as anything more than that. And the good news is these endorsements usually don't matter. The mobilized people matter a lot more. And if anything, I think it's a sign of Markey's strength.
Yeah, I do wonder if this is a little bit more akin to Chuck Schumer's, you know, like last minute endorsement in the New York primary challenge recently, as opposed to what it's being presented as is a possible Clyburn last minute endorsement. It seems a little bit more like the former.
No, look, I have a lot of respect for the speaker, even though I disagree with her. And you know, if she was endorsing someone in San Francisco for her seat, that may have a Clyburn effect, but not in Massachusetts. I don't think Clyburn's endorsement in Massachusetts would have the impact it has in South Carolina.
I think that you're probably right. And Congressman, as always, we appreciate you taking time out in a busy week to speak with
us. Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.